Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Pull the shades, put on your skeptic's cap, leave your friends and family behind, and climb on board. Today's show is all about conspiracies, cults, and cons. From the magic bullet that killed JFK to Jim Jones' cyanide punch to the Ponzi scheme, America has a sordid history with conspiracies, cults, and cons. And we're going to look at elements of all three, starting with our propensity to believe in conspiracies. The University of Miami's Joe Uzinski is co-author of American Conspiracy Theories. Joseph, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So here in the United States, is there a profile, a kind of personality type more prone to believing in conspiracies than others?
You would think there is. And I think if most of your audience closed their eyes for a moment and I asked them just to imagine what the conspiracy theorist might look like.
I'm going to say white male.
Yeah, exactly. It would be a white male, perhaps somebody living with their mother, spending a lot of time in the garage or the basement with a ham radio, and probably with political predispositions somewhere off on the right.
Mm-hmm.
But what we find is that people of both political parties are equally conspiratorial.
Really?
What we find is that men and women are equally conspiratorial, and conspiracism runs across the races. Take the show The View, mm-hmm. which is hosted by all women and aimed at women. Most of the hosts on there have conspiratorial beliefs. I mean, Whoopi Goldberg has said that she thought the moon landing was fake. Jenny McCarthy believes in vaccine conspiracy theories. Star Jones has expressed conspiracy theories in the past. Rosie O'Donnell believes there was a plot behind the 9/11 terror attacks in 2001.
Wowie. That's a pretty mainstream show for views that I thought were kind of extreme.
Exactly. But what's interesting is when we think of that conspiracy theorist, we immediately think of a male, but women are just as likely to do it as men.
How about education and age?
The interesting thing that we find is that people with less education tend to be slightly more conspiratorial than people with more education. But that's an average. I could tell you as a faculty member at a major research university, there are quite a few of my colleagues who believe in conspiracy theories.
Any particular age group or cohort more conspiratorially minded than others in the U.S.?
Gen Xers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So those people who were born in the 1960s and 1970s.
Any theories on that?
Well, when these people were born, they grew up in an age where trust in government amongst the adult population had dipped to a historic low. And the reason for that is you have Vietnam, you have Watergate, and that is the environment in which Gen Xers were raised. Those were their formidable years. So that led them to be less trusting, and we can see that in their popular culture. So, for instance, a big show amongst people who were born in the 60s and 70s, once they became young adults, was The X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, The X-Files was the prototypical conspiracy show where the government was evil and always conspiring and always out to do bad stuff. Fast forward 15 or 20 years, when you have the millennial generation come along, this generation is more trusting, more involved in government, they're more social. And the popular culture that's aimed at them reflects that. So take the show called Fringe, which aired for 5 years on Fox, which was very similar to The X-Files. The only difference between the two shows was that on Fringe, the government was friendly and never involved in the conspiracy theory. In X-Files, the government was fairly evil.
Looking across American history, what is it that tends to spark conspiratorial notions?
The big reason for why people believe in conspiracy theories is that some people just have that worldview more so than other people.
So it's like a predisposition towards conspiracy?
Exactly. So what political scientists have been working on for the last 60 or 70 years is to try and understand why people hold the opinions that they do. And what they find is that most opinions that people have in their adulthood stem directly from their socialization, from what they experienced when they were younger, from their parents, from their education, from their friends, from their social background. And that's what forms a lot of their political opinions. And conspiracism is really just another type of political opinion. So unlike a line going from far left to far right, it's a line going from very trusting to very distrusting and very conspiratorial.
Well, what I found fascinating in your book is that this kind of belief system is as old as the Republic itself.
Of course. I mean, if you go back to the Declaration of Independence, the first couple of paragraphs of that beautiful document are just some of the best political prose ever written, some of the best ideas ever written, and they form the basis of our nation. But then you go beyond that, and it's conspiracy stuff. In the original document that Jefferson drafted, he had a lot more charges against the king, which became very pedantic, and the other founders removed them out from the final document. But what you find is conspiracy rhetoric.
Like what?
In the Declaration of Independence. They accused the king of wanting to set up a tyranny. Mm-hmm. There was no evidence of that. But one of the justifications for independence was grounded in shaky conspiracy theories.
Which is so interesting because you think of, these are the aristocrats of early America, the founding fathers, the men of the Enlightenment. And my perhaps misapprehension is that conspiracies find traction in groups who feel powerless, who feel that, they're being stepped on, that feel disconnected from others.
Absolutely. And one of the chapters in the book is called Conspiracy Theories Are for Losers. And we don't mean this in a pejorative or insulting way. Instead, what we mean is that people who are out of power or people who lose power tend to use conspiracy theories as a tool to stop those losses, to try to get their people together, to alert each other to the danger that stems from those who are in power. So whatever party holds the White House, they're the ones who take the brunt of the conspiracy theories. Who gets accused of conspiracy right now? It's Obama and the Democrats.
Right.
Why? Because they're in power. I mean, they've been accused of pretty much everything, from orchestrating Sandy Hook to orchestrating the Boston Marathon bombings to having a fake birth certificate to blowing up the Deepwater Horizon well. But go back a few years. Before he took office, who was accused of conspiring? It was George W. Bush and the
mm-hmm.
Republicans,
right.
That they blew up the Twin Towers, that he was going to become a king, that he was fraudulently elected through some sort of scheme and skullduggery in Florida.
Well, so you're leading to something, Joseph Uzinski, that there is a lot of evidence out there that debunks many conspiracies. You know, we have seen President Obama's birth certificate, for example, evidence that 9/11 was not an inside job. Vaccinations are not linked to autism. So why are people unwilling to give them up?
Because a lot of people are unwilling to give up any belief. So this isn't unique to conspiracy theories. I mean, try to talk somebody out of being a Catholic or talk somebody out of being Jewish or atheist. You're not going to get very far. Try to talk somebody out of being a Republican or a Democrat. So when people latch onto a belief, they're usually unwilling to give it up. And what political scientists find is that when we do experiments on people and we try to give them information that contradicts their conspiracy theories, they double down on the conspiracy theory. They reject information that doesn't support their beliefs.
Well, why do some stick and others don't? JFK was killed by the CIA, or he was killed by Castro, or he was killed by the mob. Those seem to still be rattling around versus Vince Foster, murdered by the Clinton administration, maybe had a little peak and maybe went down. I'm not sure. But why do you think some conspiracies keep a tight hold on the American imagination?
Well, that's a really good question, and your premise is absolutely correct. One thing that we do in the book is we go back and we look at 120 years worth of conspiracy theories, and most of them you would never have heard of. They show up, and then they come and go in the night. So one thing we did with our data collection was try to catch the big fish as well as the small fish. So, for instance, in our research, we found conspiracy theories that claimed that the CIA had created lesbianism as part of a plot. We found conspiracy theories that said the government was out to kill all of our pet dogs. That conspiracy was popular, 110 years ago. Obviously, it hasn't come true yet. there are tons of them out there. Very few get a lot of adherence. And in fact, you know, the vast majority don't. Another thing we did in the book, too, was to track conspiracy theories on the Internet. And we picked up about 3,500 in the course of a year in major newspaper, in major news outlets. And the vast majority of them are things that we'll talk about for a day, and then we, you know, we'll forget about the day after.
Well, you're leading me to a question. Have we become more conspiracy-minded in the digital media age when everyone can access reams of information to substantiate theories or proofs of conspiracies?
The most interesting answer here is no.
Really?
So one thing we did in the book was to track, you know, the prevalence of conspiracy theories over time. We find it's actually going down slightly. You might think that the Internet is driving people to become more conspiratorial because there's more conspiracy theories on the Internet. Just because they're out there doesn't mean people are racing out to look at them.
Joseph Yuzinski, you know, you talked about the hosts of The View, your colleagues. Many of us harbor conspiracy theories. And I'm trying to figure out that line between conspiracist and healthy skepticism. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that our government has not always been above board, no matter who is in power. We find the NSA has been spying on us. CIA assassinations have been conducted in the past. So what is that distinction between the conspiracist and the skeptic?
So just to be clear, there's nothing wrong with it. So one thing that we do in the book is we don't take a position on which ones are true or which ones are false, and we don't take a position on is conspiracy theorizing, you know, all good or all bad. Like anything else, it's some good and some bad, and it's there are healthy aspects to it and unhealthy aspects to it. So the healthy part is that in a democracy, you have to have some skepticism of people in power. Whether it's corporations or your state government or the national government, there has to be people who are actively investigating them, who are actively skeptical. That's the whole point of democracy. It's not to give people power and let them rule over us. It's to give them power and then take it away if they abuse it. On the other hand, there is an unhealthy aspect to this, too. Conspiracy theorists seem to be more accepting of violence. You know, we don't know if conspiracy theorists are more likely to commit actual violence. But there are anecdotes out there. Timothy McVeigh was a conspiracy theorist. He thought that the government was out to take away his gun rights, so he decided to conspire against the government and blow up a federal building in Oklahoma. The Boston Marathon bombers were conspiracy theorists. They believed in Jewish conspiracy theories. They believed in 9/11 truth conspiracy theories. And they took pretty violent action against people.
Joseph Yuzinski, fascinating to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Joseph Yuzinski, an assistant professor in the University of Miami Political Science Department and co-author of American Conspiracy Theories. And we're going to continue our tour of conspiracies, cults, and cons with the second item on that list, cults. When Word of Mouth returns, we'll hear from a woman who grew up in a closed religious community in East Leominster, New Hampshire. She eventually fled what she calls a cult-like environment at the age of 18. We'll hear her story after the break.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Well, that's
it. Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Mormon Church, the Branch Davidians, Freemasons, the Manson family, Heaven's Gate, Scientology. At some point in American history, each of these widely varying groups has been deemed a cult, which raises the surprisingly evasive question, what makes a cult a cult? In August of 1966, a nonprofit corporation called Highview Church Farm was incorporated in East Leominster, New Hampshire. According to an article of agreement, its purpose was, quote, to propagate the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ in the United States of America and other countries through any means, unquote. Those means included print, broadcast, movies, and recordings, and the training and support of workers through school camps offering Bible study and preparation in technical agriculture or recreational skills. The latter is where Kate Gale fits in. She grew up on Highview Church Farm, doing what the church considered propagating the gospel of Jesus Christ. Kate left when she turned 18 with just the clothes on her back. She's now founder and manager of Red Hen Press. When we spoke, I asked her about her childhood in a closed religious community.
When I was three, my mother joined a closed Christian community, some might call it a cult, in East Leominster, New Hampshire, which had been founded by George Eversfield. And he had collected several hundred people there. They gave him everything they owned, including their children. So the children were raised in this separate space, which they called Highview Church Farm School. And this group came to be known in public as the, quote, Jolly Farmers, because eventually they had a business called the Jolly Farmer, where there was a restaurant and a bakery and so on, and they sold sweaters. So the adults worked for George in his various businesses, and the kids all lived in this school, about 80 of us. So, you know, we all slept on the floor. We worked a lot of the time. We read the Bible. We listened to Handel's Messiah.
When was this, by the way?
So this was in 66, and I ended up leaving there in 1981.
Wow.
And basically, people didn't leave unless they had a family to go to, which I didn't. Mm-hmm. So when I left, I had a harmonica, a dog on a baling twine string, a sleeping bag, and $2. I did not have a Social Security number. I had never slept in a bed. I had never exchanged money, so I didn't really know that. Of course, I had never had a paying job, so I didn't know how that was working. And so I was a very ridiculously naive little person at 18.
And it wasn't just your mother you left behind. You had siblings.
Right. So my sister was still there. And so my mother and sister I said goodbye to when I left. And obviously everyone I knew in the whole world.
Now, you could willfully leave.
Yes, you could. I mean, you could leave. You could just walk down the street. But I think for the most part, people didn't. I mean, obviously, a few other people had left and gone to be with their families. So there are people that had outside families. But I think most of the reason people didn't leave was that you were completely convinced that if you left, you would go to hell. Mm. And so the thing people always say, so what was sort of a moment for you when you knew you were going to leave? But the moment was when I thought, even if I stayed, I was probably going to go to hell, because I was definitely not a well-behaved young person. And so I thought, if I'm going there anyway, then maybe I should see the outside world and have some fun.
Well, what would be a form of rebellion, according to this closed Christian community, as you call it?
Well, you know, getting up in the middle of the night to read books, sneaking, you know, there were books that people would come in with stuff, and books were supposed to be gotten rid of for the most part. And so sometimes I would sneak those books. So
like what kinds of books?
I was very fond of a book called Scottish Chiefs by Jane Porter. It's a ridiculously maudlin book in which, you know, William Wallace is carrying this woman around. And, you know, they have this sort of higher love that doesn't involve sex. I was so excited by this at 15. I can't even tell you. So I would read ridiculous books like that and get in trouble for it.
So all that you were supposed to be reading was what, the Bible? Or
mostly just the Bible, mm-hmm. Yes.
There were a lot of back-to-the-earth communes back then. You know, we see photographs of hippies and their kids working on farms. What separated this? What made it a cult, as far as you're concerned?
Well, you know, interestingly, in this country, communes or cults, whatever, you know, people want to call them, and it really is a matter of naming. It's like, what's the difference between a freedom fighter and a guerrilla? Mm. You know, it depends what side you're on. But What I think makes a commune a cult is very simple. Who's in charge? Mm-hmm. And if you are not in charge of your own destiny, if you can't come and go, if somebody's telling you what to do all the time and who to marry, that's a cult, because it means that you're brainwashed. You're being told who to be in the world. So at some point, I knew who I was going to marry. I knew what I was supposed to do on every day, and everybody else knew what they were going to do every day. And then the leader guy, George Eversfield, everything when people joined there, they had to give everything to the farm. So they had no possessions. And if you were a religious person and you said, well, that's what they did in Acts of the Apostles, which, by the way, was what the farm was based on, I would say that Acts of the Apostles was voluntary, short-lived, and for a specific situation. And that cults, you've given up your own will. It's not short-lived. And it's not for a specific situation. It's your whole life.
Did you have any indication of what was going on in the outside world? Was there interaction, you know, with the people in town in East Leominster?
No, the adults went to town meetings. And in fact, the town of East Leominster is only 400 people or was then. And so essentially the farm could come in with all of their adults and outvote everybody else as long as just a small portion of the town showed up, which would be normal. So in other words, the adults had these town meetings that they went to. As a kid, my only time of seeing the outside world would have been like once a year. We'd go into Newport and we'd sometimes shop at a thrift store there, or sometimes we'd get shoes.
We're talking with Kate Gale. She is a writer and a poet, and she's also the founder and managing editor of Red Hen Press, about her long and winding road to get there. Really interesting story. But also I just sort of latched onto this idea of you sort of sneaking away and reading books. And then you became a writer and a publisher. Was writing therapy for you when you first got out?
Well, I did like books a lot growing up. But the other thing was that, so I grew up with this group of 10 to 20 girls would be in a dorm room together. And especially in the early years, I would start telling people stories in the room. And in those stories, like, we were always conquering everybody. And eventually we'd be living in a world with no grown-ups, kind of like Pinocchio or something. And we would just be eating cookies and stuff like that. And so the idea formed very early for me that stories change everything. They create magic. And so when I left, I really wanted to be a writer because I wanted to write stories down and change myself and the world through stories.
Where some people might think of that as grandiose, you thought, wow, I've done the most difficult thing in the world already.
Yeah. I've already walked away with a harmonica and a dog, so don't even tell me I can't do this. I got this.
These things, that was normalized for you, I guess, on some level. And I wonder about that people who have these kind of extreme ideological beginnings, they're often, go through their life being deprogrammed in some sort of way or going through therapy. Are there any of these remnants for you when you're reading, when you're doing work throughout your day of like, oh, I'm going to burn for that, or, any other sort of psychological plow, invisible plow you're carrying around?
Well, I think that the remnants of the farm in my life, I have a big garden. Ever since I moved to LA 25 years ago, I've always had chickens. Every house I've been to, I've had chickens. My kids were not allowed to have any television growing up. They could have, we had endless books, but no television. They were only allowed to have one pair of shoes at a time that fit, because I said when I was growing up, I only had one pair of shoes. So I think that a lot of the way I ended up living my life was very much influenced. In the sense of feeling guilty, I think that there's obviously some of that. I mean, for example, everyone of my generation, was smoking weed and doing drugs in college. And, it wasn't like I was never doing anything, but I was never going to get into that, really. I was never going to become part of that scene. And part of that was I grew up in a cult. And so the idea of just becoming a pot smoker, and trying other drugs, let's try some Quaaludes or something, it just wasn't going to be possible. It would have been going way too far from my beginnings.
So you grew up with a lot of deprivation. I wonder, have you forgiven your mother for putting you in this situation as a young girl?
Well, I have. I believe that if you don't forgive someone for something, then you're just carrying your own basket of pain around. It doesn't actually hurt them at all. It just hurts you. On the other hand, I don't think that for me, forgiveness just means I'm okay, you're okay, and I'm okay with you. it doesn't mean that's okay, what happened. I don't think there's a way of saying that was okay. You know, when my kids were growing up and they would say, like, you know, you're not doing a very good job as a mom, when they would be pissed off at me. And I would say, well, I'm doing a better job than my mom. And then they would say, when we were still living with you at the age of four, you were doing a better job. The bar wasn't very high. I definitely feel that I've forgiven with her and that I'm fine with her. However, I wouldn't say that doing this kind of thing is okay.
Kate Gale is the founder and managing editor of Red Hand Press, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. She's also author of several books of poetry, including Mating Season and the novel Lake of Fire. And a little postscript to our interview, which took place last month. The Jolly Farmer is no longer based in East Leominster, New Hampshire. They relocated their church and their farm to New Brunswick, Canada. And we continue our exploration of conspiracies, cults, and cons with the huckster, the trickster, the flimflam man. No matter what you call them, American dreamers are easy marks for a good con artist. Producer Nate DeMayo of the Memory Palace brings us this story of one of the greatest cons in American history.
Henry Nichols wakes up early one Saturday and rides out to Stubb Newell's farm. Stubb is his brother-in-law, and sometimes he throws him some cash to do some odd jobs, like paint a fence or whatever. This time it's to dig a well. Henry brings his buddy Gideon with him. Gideon had lost his arm a few years back in the Civil War, but he says he'd be willing to give Henry a hand, so to speak. And Stubb takes them out to the field behind his barn, points to some spot in the ground. It seems totally arbitrary. And Henry and Gideon start digging. And the whole thing is taking forever. The ground is really hard, and they're digging for hours. Then Henry's shovel hits something. Gideon clambers down into the hole, starts clearing away the dirt with his one hand, and he finds a foot, a giant foot. George Hull was getting nowhere. He had spent years farming tobacco in upstate New York, trying to find riches in the soil. He had done pretty well during the war. People wanted their cigars, and they couldn't get them from the Carolinas anymore. Then the South surrendered, and everything went south, up north. His business fell apart. So George Hull decided to look for actual riches in the dirt. He headed to the gold fields of California. And on his way west, Hull stops in Ackley, Iowa. And he's at a bar and he gets into an argument with a Methodist preacher. George Hull is an atheist, and a loud one. And the preacher is a drinker, and a loud one, and the two go at it about the Bible all night long. The preacher is all literal word of God on one side, and Hull's all book of fairy stories on the other. And the crux of their particular version of this predictable argument hinges upon a line in Genesis that says, "There were giants upon the earth in those days." And that is just too much for George Hull. He can't stand how dumb people are. They'll just believe anything. Henry and Gideon believed they had found a dead Indian. That's what they said when Stubb Newell came back to check on how well the well was doing. "I declare," one of them said, "some old Indian has been buried here." And it was some old Indian. The body that lay there in the dirt was 10 feet tall. It was hard as a rock, heavy as hell. A nude male figure lying prone, twisted slightly at the hips, sort of smiling. Henry and Gideon started freaking out. For years they had heard the people of the Onondaga tribe tell stories of stone giants that lived in the forest. Maybe this was one of them. And maybe it would wake up. But Stubb Newell had a different theory, one that had been handed to him by George Hull. One night, 2 years earlier, Hull had ridden into Cardiff, New York, looking for someone who had a farm, a shovel, and a good poker face, because he had a giant he was looking to unload. He found his man in Stubb Newell. Hull had told him about the preacher in Iowa, and how annoyed he had made him, and how he wanted to stick it to that guy. And stick it to everyone, really, who believed in nonsense and hokum. So he came up with a plan for a grand hoax. He would make a petrified man. It can take millions of years to petrify something. It took George Hull, too. He spent a few months getting money together by selling off shares of the inevitable windfall that a petrified man would bring. It took a while longer to find a giant block of marble and a sculptor to carve it into a giant, and then time to make this freshly carved statue look like ancient flesh. He's sanding it down and chipping out chunks of ankle and shoulder and thigh, and dipping it in acid until it looked the way he imagined a giant man would have if he had fallen into a bog back in the time before Abraham, and then had become petrified. And then he dug a hole in the dead of night. A year later, Stubb Newell was standing by a hole in the ground, with a lump in his throat. A day after orchestrating the incredible discovery of a biblical giant in his backyard, he was already making money off of it. He'd put a rope around the pit and charged his neighbors $1 for a closer look. But the big payoff, the riches he'd been fantasizing about since George Hall knocked on his door the spring before, depended on the four men in the hole. People needed to believe it. It was one thing for some farmers and field hands to awe-shuck some word of mouth around his little hamlet. His neighbors would believe anything. For the giant to really draw a crowd, he needed people with some actual authority to buy in. He needed scientists. And here were four doctors from neighboring towns, trained physicians, crawling through the dirt, poking and measuring, and conferring in authoritative tones. And when the four men climbed up from the hole, muddy and wide-eyed, and declared that the giant was the genuine article, Stubb Newell breathed easier, and he put up a tent. The world descended upon Cardiff, New York. Headlines called the statue the Cardiff Giant and called it the biggest scientific discovery of the century. Tourists rode in on horseback and omnibus. Within weeks, whole hotels were built to house the gawking throng. Stubb Newell was making money giant hand over giant fist and squirreling it away for George Hall and his secret cabal of investors. And then they took the giant on the road, and at every stop, the crowds grew. But so did the risk. Each town had its own experts, its professors, its lecturers of note, who'd all take a crack at the giant. But most bought it. The giant, Genesis, the whole thing. Some didn't, and they said it was a statue, but an ancient statue from some lost civilization, which would have been a giant discovery, if not a petrified one. But every now and then, someone would call it what it was, just a giant scam. But George Hall and his investors managed to stay a step ahead, moving on to another city before people caught on and demanded answers, and they would have to own up to reality. There was one person who didn't care at all whether it was real. P.T. Barnum knew a good show when he saw one, and he made them an offer. He would pay them $60,000 to rent the giant for 3 months. And this was a good deal. That's about $1 million of today's dollars. And George Hall had only spent the equivalent of $30,000 to make his petrified marvel. Their tour was still doing well, but not that well. They'd never make that kind of money in 3 months. They didn't have Barnum's promotional genius. And most importantly, they didn't have his mammoth museum in downtown Manhattan. But they didn't take the offer. Because Manhattan was the problem. They had managed to make a small fortune off an outrageous fake. But people were starting to poke holes in the story, letting little drops of doubt seep in. 3 months in the spotlight, in the biggest city in the world, the whole thing was bound to get washed away. So they said no. And Barnum said fine. And then he made his own giant. No one could figure out exactly how he did it. Maybe someone made a plaster cast in the dead of night. Maybe someone had been surreptitiously making elaborate sketches at every stop on the tour. But in the fall of 1869, an exact replica of the Cardiff Giant went on display in Barnum's museum. And of course he claimed it was the real thing. The owners of the real fake giant were outraged. They threatened to sue. And Barnum said, bring it on. You bring your giant into court, and I'll bring mine, and we'll ask a judge to decide which one is really a petrified person. George Hall knew he was beat. He signed a book deal, and then he admitted the whole thing. And people still came to see the giant for a while. It may not have been a real magical, mythical creature, but it was still pretty cool. It wasn't a real giant, but it was a giant celebrity. And George Hall took his money, and he sold some books. In reading the book, George Hall seems like kind of a dick. And this from a person who loves a good hoax. I can totally get behind a charismatic con man. But George Hell began this whole thing with the premise that people are idiots. And looking back on it, he seems pretty smug. Like he was sure that he pulled the rug out from under the faithful fools who bought into this biblical stuff and this magic and mystical nonsense. But the truth is, he didn't have a rug. He had a tablecloth. You yank it out and the silverware is still in place. You haven't spilled a drop. If belief could survive Copernicus and Galileo, it could survive the Cardiff Giant. And you didn't have to be a fool to be fooled in 1869. You were a farmer. You were a dock worker or a candlestick maker or a scrivener. Where had you ever been? What had you ever seen? How good were your textbooks? How learned were your learned men? And this fake giant had real power. One day you're tilling your field or you're working your terrible job, living your hard life. Someone over yonder digs up a giant in their backyard. It had enough power to change people's days, to draw a crowd, and to make some people rich. It gave a one-handed farmhand a story to dine out on for the rest of his life back in the 1870s. It gave him a Wikipedia entry today. It sounds enough like magic to me. I pay a dollar to see that.
And that story came to us from Nate DeMayo in the Memory Palace podcast. You'll find a link to more on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, the public may be easy to dupe, but how do you con a con? When Word of Mouth continues, we'll hear from a journalist who did just that by going undercover as an inmate in several American jails. That's after a quick break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Throughout today's show, we've been exploring American conspiracies, cults, and cons. Our next guest is a Brit, which has been an asset for his scam. The journalist Alexander Reynolds has been investigating conditions in American jails in a pretty unorthodox way by going undercover as a volunteer detainee. So what does it take to con a bunch of cons? He tells that story in a new book called Convictland, Undercover in America's Jails. And Alexander Reynolds, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the U.S. prison system seems like it would be pretty tough to penetrate. How did you gain access to these jails in the first place?
Well, I discovered that I could go to jail in America as an undercover voluntary detainee, and with the right procedure, I could gain admittance to holding facilities in places like Arizona, Kansas, Nebraska, and North Dakota just by lobbying the boss, that be the jail supervisor or the county sheriff.
So beyond the sheriff and the supervisor, was anyone else aware you were working undercover?
No, that varied from facility to facility, but the sheriff or the jail supervisor, they were always very interested in feedback from behind the bars. How were inmates treated? How were they fed? How were they watered? Were the guards abusive? And in some instances, in particular this one facility I was up at in Cass County Jail in Fargo, North Dakota, when the corrections officers found out that I was undercover, they got the hump.
What does that mean?
It means that they were very angry with the jail supervisor for letting in somebody undercover to go and snoop on them.
Hmm. Why did you choose to go undercover in U.S. jails in the first place?
Well, that was the only place I could get admittance.
Really?
Yes. I had more luck getting entry into American facilities than I did anywhere else in the world, and that includes my own country. I lobbied the UK Home Office for access to holding facilities in the UK, and they told me to bog off, to put it mildly.
What was your cover story for being thrown into jail? What crimes had you committed when you did
that? Now that varied. The first cover story was driving on the wrong side of the road in a stolen car in possession of methamphetamine.
Well, I guess it would make sense you'd be riding on the wrong side of the road.
Oh, of course, I'm English and it happens all the time.
How about your other stories? I know from reading that you had supposedly stolen a car, for example. What are the other crimes you came up with?
Well, sometimes the sheriffs or the jail supervisor would come up with the crime for me. So in Nebraska, I was booked in for espionage, and that was for spying on planes in South Dakota, chased across the state line, arrested by the cops and on hold for the feds. So that was an interesting story, booking into jail undercover as a spy, ostensibly. And one of the other cover stories was getting into a fight in a pub and getting tasered. And I actually got myself tasered, and the video's up on YouTube if you want to check it out, to cement that cover story.
Well, you were a spy on some level, but did things ever get dicey? I mean, did your cover ever get nearly blown or threatened? I know once, you know, someone thought, if you keep talking to me, they'll think you're a narc, for example.
Yeah, that happened to me a couple of times. I mean, I did have trouble a couple of times, but you just have to stick to the story, and also you have to stick up for yourself. But, you know, if somebody was asking me questions, I go, what's with all the questions? Do you work for the police? Yeah. I would turn it round on them. And if they carried on, you know, I'd have punched them in the face.
Well, coming up with a story is one thing, Alexander. How about physical or psychological preparations for going inside?
Physical preparations. My wife was a civil servant and we were posted overseas in Thailand. And I'd been an amateur Thai boxer, kickboxer in the UK, and I took it up professionally when I went to Thailand, and I was doing that for 9 years over there.
Wow.
So, like, when I was going over there on the job, you know, I was in very good nick. I was in very good shape. So if somebody did want to fight me, you know, I put an elbow in their mush. Psychologically, I mean, I was the biggest concern for me was not so much being banged up, was not having access to things like cigarettes or good food. I mean, the bad food was punishment enough for me.
Well, you're quite obviously British. Did that work for or against you in jail?
Well, they all thought I was Australian. I turned up and they're calling me Crocodile Dundee and making jokes about all sorts of things. So, I mean, I wasn't... That was funny. And then there was they would never suspect me of being undercover because I was a foreigner.
Mm.
That was a good thing. That did work in my favor. And, you know, being a criminal separated by a common language, that was also made for a lot of fun. I mean, I often, when I speak to people, I slip into English slang. So a lot of times the slang that I was using confused the inmates I was in with. But of course, I was able to understand all of them because, you know, people know about American culture through films and television. They don't really know so much about British culture over here.
Mm.
They all think we're like Hugh Grant.
Well, you're bringing up an interesting point because one of the things you write in the book is that a lot of people's impression of life in jail, it comes from television or films. So for us, set the scene for your first stay in jail. What were you expecting and did these conditions surprise you?
Well, what shocked me was when I went into, I think Salina County Jail, was how much it looked like a jail or a prison from a movie, and it looked just like the set from Oz, the HBO soap opera.
Oh my God, I would not want to land there.
And I went to another facility that looked just like Oz, and it was full of people just like Oz, all sorts of groups, all sorts of people. I mean, and people keeping themselves to themselves. I mean, racially, I mean, the Latinos would stick to themselves, the African Americans would stick to themselves, and the Caucasians would. And the racism that I came across was appalling and endemic.
We're speaking with the journalist Alexander Reynolds, who went undercover in several of America's jails and wrote about the experience in a book called Convict Land. Walk us through a typical day in an American jail. Is there something like a typical routine?
Oh, now, that varies from place to place, but usually, you know, you got reveille at about 8 o'clock in the morning, and then some places they'd make you clean up the cell block, and then they feed you. And then, of course, there's television, and television can be monitored or unmonitored. And it's basically like a long-stay car park. I mean, when you're thrown into these places, you're not made to do any meaningful work. There's an absence of rehabilitation. And that was the thing that really shocked me, was that I just felt like I was in a long stay car park.
Well, you mentioned Nebraska, Kansas. You were also in North Dakota and Arizona. Tell us about that experience in Maricopa County. Now, this is where Sheriff Joe Arpaio, a name that may be well known to many Americans, wields considerable power, somewhat notoriously in the case of prisons. Tell us about the experience in Maricopa County.
Yeah, well, that's actually a county jail he's running down there. And what shocked me about that place was Tent City.
Would you compare it to a concentration camp?
Yes, it is a concentration camp. And I couldn't believe that such a thing could exist in America until I saw it with my own eyes.
Well, describe it for us.
Well, you've got bundles of razor wire, a perimeter, you've got a guard tower with a neon sign that says welcome for business. You've got men and women living out there in the searing desert.
In tents.
Yeah. They're Korean War surplus tents. And he is very indifferent about how they're kept. The costs of building a new facility for the jail was so much, he thought, well, you know, to hell with that. I'm going to put up tents instead.
Now, this is a guy we've read reports about. He keeps prisoners who are on work sites in chains, ankle chains, so, you know, sort of like the chain gangs of old, striped uniforms, and notable for their pink underwear, even for the men. What's the story there?
Yeah, the pink underwear. Right. Well, people kept stealing the white underwear, and so we had it dyed pink so nobody would steal it. But that didn't stop me stealing my pink underwear, which I still wear. And the pink thermal top I stole from there is great. And matching pink handcuffs.
As we mentioned, you were at a number of different facilities. So was there any commonality among your fellow prisoners? Why they were in, you know, what they looked like, demographics?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of people who were behind bars who didn't really belong there. I mean, people with drink and drug problems, better served by a stint in, you know, a Betty Ford type clinic. There was also like a rapidly aging prison population. And of course, you know, a great many women. I mean, America imprisons more women than any other country in the world, more black people than any other country in the world.
You mentioned addiction. Mental illness is something that also comes up a lot. How are these conditions treated in jail?
They're not treated. Say, for instance, if you're coming off methamphetamine, the most you would get is a headache pill, mm-hmm. and you'd be in solitary for 2 or 3 days to sweat it out.
Right. You'd be detoxing heavy, I imagine, from that.
Yeah. And, you know, the staff's not trained to deal with that. You know, I mean, that's the thing about going into this world was just seeing how tough the job is for detention officers. And they do this work in society that goes unrecognized and largely unrewarded. I mean, nobody really cares about the people who work in corrections. And it's a multifaceted job. You know, they have to be a psychiatric nurse. They have to be a social worker. They have to be a nightclub bouncer. You know, you'd be meeting guys, corrections officers who were very good at their jobs, you know, who were softly, softly approach. And then you'd meet others who were just total Nazis, who seemed to get off on abusing the inmates physically and psychologically.
Well, so what comes across in speaking to you and also in your book is you have some doubts about the efficacy of incarceration as punishment, as rehabilitation. So you've clearly come away not believing that the U.S. is achieving those goals. Do you think, Alexander Reynolds, that you've sort of crossed over now after your undercover experience in prison from journalist taking this all in to activist working against it?
Yeah, I've become a reluctant activist in that sense, because it is what I did discover when I come out from all of these expeditions and when I'd be talking to friends and acquaintances is how little people know about the subject, and they don't really care about the people behind bars. But also the great ignorance. Like, I'd be talking to Americans and they were totally unaware that America has 2.3 million people behind bars and the system costs $80 billion a year. People don't apply the same kind of scrutiny to this kind of spending that they do to other forms of government spending. And then we keep talking about privatization. And privatization is not a panacea. It is a Pandora's box.
Why do you say that?
Well, because taxpayers' money is going towards private corporations who don't care about lowering the crime rate. It's in their interest to keep these facilities 90% full. They want revolving doors and they don't really care about rehabilitation. And you've got companies like Corrections Corporation of America, you know, for 30 years now, they've been selling private prisons in the USA. And one company founder was quoted as saying that it's just like selling cars or real estate or hamburgers.
Well, Alexander Reynolds, I sure hope you stay out of trouble. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alexander Reynolds, a journalist and author of Convict Land, Undercover in America's Jails. You can find more on the book and look at some videos of interviews and also some of the experiences that Alexander had in prison. The links are at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for stepping right up, ladies and gents, and listening to today's exploration of our imperfect relationship with the truth. If you like what you heard, there's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. And if you missed any part of the show, you can catch up by subscribing to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can find it on iTunes or find the link at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Look out for the offer that's too good to be true. And please find us again on Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.